Point of order, Madam Chair.
Call the meeting to order. I call House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday. Still, we're at 4 o'clock. We had began on Thursday speaking on criminal justice review, starting with SB 91 and working through HB 54 and HB 138 and how all those go together as we are anticipating a crime bill coming our way and what issues that we may still need to fix and some that may need a little bit more data coming to us to seeing whether or not those programs that we put together are finally showing that reaping the rewards we had hoped for. And with that, we're going to have Ms. Mead come up. And Ms. Winkleman. Don't want to leave you out. And we're going to have Ms. Mead just finish up on so that she doesn't have to stay up there the whole time. Then we'll go back in and take care of our criminal, as he went to jail last time we had heard. So on the parole probation, the court does still play a part in the parole probation period. And Ms. Mead's just going to go through what part the judges still do as far as ordering programs or conditions upon release. Ms. Mead.
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. The other day, I basically finished going through pretrial and sentencing pieces of our criminal justice system and some of the other big changes, as the chair stated, left to talk about in terms of criminal justice is the probation and parole program. Some people get those mixed up, what is probation and what is parole. Very briefly, the court orders a probationary term, and parole, in contrast, is 100% handled by the Department of Corrections. So a person can be simultaneously on probation and parole. If they violate terms of probation, they come back to the court. If they violate terms of parole, they go back to DOC. The court has zero to do with parole. But we do have something to do with probation. So very often with criminal sentences, the person might be sentenced to 10 years with a certain 3 years suspended, for example. And in addition to your term of imprisonment, the court can order terms of probation, and usually does. Those maximums were changed with SB 91, but generally the law right now is that for a felony sex offense, the maximum is 15 years. An unclassified felony, the maximum is 10 years, other felonies, 5 years. There are other sort of specific things for 1141s, which are crimes against a person, typically assaults and things like that. For domestic violence, for sex crimes that are misdemeanors, the maximum's 3 years, second DUI, 2 years, and other misdemeanors, 1 year. Also, there are minimums for sex felonies. Unclassifieds are 15 years. A or B felony sex crimes are 10 years. And C is 5 years. So those are set in statute. They're just not movable, so the court has some discretion within there to order certain terms of probationary terms. During the probationary term, the law allows certain ways for a person to get off probation earlier than the court ordered. Some of those are the subject of some of the governor's crime bills to adjust those. But right now, the probation officer recommends a termination of probation for somebody who's in compliance with, all their conditions after set time periods as well. Those set time periods were adjusted in SB 54 to different time periods. But in essence, right now, the probation officer does recommend a termination of probation after 2 years for A, B felonies, and 1 year for C and others. This does not apply to unclassified offenses, sex offenses, or DV offenses. And SB 54 changed the 1 year to 18 months. So there is a way, if somebody is complying with everything they're supposed to be doing, to get off probation early. And in addition, SB 91 added credits during your period of probation, so that for each month that a person does well, they get could get a month shortened off the end of their time period. So as you can see from the math, a person could have their probationary term cut in half if they are in compliance with all their probationary conditions. There are a number of conditions the court can impose for probation, and our typical judgment has a whole list of them. Some are pre-checked, as in always going to be imposed. For example, must obey all federal, state, and local laws. Others the judge can consider depending on the crime for which the person is being sentenced. One of the most common ones is to comply with the things that your probation officer tells you to do. And another very common one is to be assessed for treatment needs and then to follow the program recommended by whoever does the assessing. So the court doesn't have the information or expertise to say you need inpatient treatment for 2 years, but what they do say is you need to be assessed and then follow the recommendation of that assessor, and that's very commonly done. The one exception is sex offender treatment. The probation statute says for certain sex offenses, the person must have as a condition to go to a sex offender treatment program. That's about the extent of what I know about those programs, but they are mandatory for certain offenses. And I think that's almost all I have to say about probation, unless there are questions.
Representative Joseph Stan.
Yes, Madam Chair, it may help to clarify that, because I have to keep this clear in my mind, but if a sentence, for example, is 6 years with three suspended, that means 3 years to serve and 3 years of suspended time. So if someone said, well, what's the period of probation? You might say, well, there's 3 years of probation. But that's different than the period of probation during which time those 3 years could be imposed. So I'm just letting folks know about that.
Is that 3 years of probation or 3 years of parole?
Through the chair, the time period that a person gets released early for good time credit, which is statutory and nearly everyone gets it unless they misbehave in a pretty serious way in the institution, that's called mandatory parole. So they are released, for example, if you have a 9-year sentence, typically and not always, good time credit under statute means that you will be released at 6 years. That remaining 3 years, you are on mandatory parole. Simultaneously, during that 3-year period, you're on probation as well, and your probationary term will have started. And so if you have a transgression, you could be brought to the court for under a petition to revoke probation, and or brought to the parole board and for a petition to revoke parole. So the court handles the probationary ones, and as Representative Josephson said, can then impose on the person that suspended time, which is literally hanging over your head, and you can go back in for those transgressions because you violated your conditions of release. With some exceptions, with SB 91, the legislature, you, added what's called technical violations of probation. So if the violation is not a new crime or failure to go to your betters program or failure to go to sex treatment, it's technical, and the first several times that you do get a petition to revoke probation, the time that you can spend, the time that the judge can impose then is capped at 3, 5, and 10 days. And the fourth time and forward, you can get all your suspended time imposed, and you can go to jail for that time period.
Do we have any idea how many are sitting currently under probation, parole, technical violations?
Through the chair, I don't know, but they're quite common, and maybe the Department of Corrections has that answer.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Jen Winkleman. I'm the Director of Probation and Parole and Pretrial, and I'm guessing on any given day we could get the number of folks that are serving time on technical violations, but I don't have that today.
Okay, if we could get that so we know what the percentage, I'd appreciate it. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair for Ms. Mead, I think I'm right about my thinking, but maybe not. So when we say someone is on or received mandatory parole, that's not really a thing the parole board deals with per se. It just means they were released after 2/3 of their time, right? In other words, there's no event to follow from that. It just means they did 6 of 9 years. or they did 4 of 6 years?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, that is my understanding, but I really do try not to answer questions about parole since it is not the court's bailiwick.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I understand correctly that with probation, somebody gets picked up with a probation violation, it isn't until their fourth probation violation that the courts would then consider imposing their maximum sentence again? Could you go back and repeat that?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, SB 91 added a statute about technical violations of probation. So, for example, if the person doesn't show up for an appointment or has a dirty urinalysis test or drug test or something like that, that's considered under the statute to be technical. So the first time that happens, when the probation officer comes to court and files a PTRP, petition to revoke the probation, the statute limits the judge's ability to impose time beyond 3 days. Okay. The second time he or she can impose 5 days for one of those technical violations, the third time 10. Thereafter, any of the suspended time can be imposed. But that doesn't count if the petition to revoke probation is based on a new crime that is not technical or not going to your betters treatment or sex offense treatment. Those are not technical, and the first time the court could impose whatever of your suspended time for those.
Thank you. Josephson.
So through the chair, Ms. Mead, my memory of this is what would happen when I was involved was if there were, for example, 2 years of suspended time, they could place the person during an adjudication hearing, they could put them back on probation with no drawdown of the suspended time. That is, they'd essentially not punish them in a concrete way. Or they would, depending on the offense, they'd tend to do 3 months of the 24 months, or maybe 5 months of the 24 months. But am I right that on these 3, 5, and 10 day hearings, the defendant is allowed to put on all the evidence he or she wants to that it didn't happen that way? So it's not just an automatic thing. There could be a full-blown hearing on those PTRs, right?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, there could be a full-blown hearing on the 3 days. What I have heard is that when there's a 3 day maximum penalty, the defendant very often pleads guilty right then and there, may have already served a day or two of it, for example, and we are not seeing many hearings, if any, on technical violations of probation. I also want to clarify that those technicals violations that I talked about excludes sex offenses, and that's even though the statute says that failure to complete your sex offense treatment is not a technical violation. So there's kind of an anomaly in the way the law is written, but in any event, the technicals don't apply for sex offenses.
Appreciate very much. So we're going to go over here now to Ms. Winkleman, and we are on page 10. And we just, offender Joe, although we'll remind, did two offenses, one that got him in trouble, and the second one while he was out, and was still back out again, but now we're going to get him sentenced. So take him from there.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. Like I said, this is Jen Winkleman. I am the Director of Probation and Parole for the record. So as the chair identified, offender Joe has now transitioned from an unsentenced inmate to a sentenced inmate on the two counts of misconduct involving a controlled substance that we mentioned last week. On those two counts, I actually was alerted to an error on the bullet point, the second bullet point here. We're going to say that offender Joe has actually 6 months suspended, not 1 year. That will make, he'll be serving a time of 1.5 years on each count, which will add up to the 3 years to serve. So each count received 2 years with 6 months suspended for a total of 3 years to serve in custody. In addition to that, the court sentenced offender Joe to 2 years of probation. And because Offender Joe was sentenced to longer than 30 days, an offender management plan, the OMP, which you'll hear several times throughout this presentation, was completed for Offender Joe. And essentially, the offender management plan is an offender-specific supervision. It's offender-specific for each offender that we have in custody that serves over, that's sentenced either to longer than 30 days or is on probation or parole. We complete one of these plans. And I'll get into that in the next slide. As Ms. Mead had mentioned, because Offender Joe is serving over 2 years in custody, he's serving 3 years, he will be eligible for mandatory parole after serving two-thirds of his sentence. And the parole board may authorize early release to discretionary parole prior to the mandated release date, and we'll get to that here in a subsequent slide. But the statutory good time will be the two-thirds off that Offender Joe will receive and he will be on mandatory parole for that part of the release. So with 3 years to serve, he will get out in 2 years, and for that final year, he will be on mandatory parole.
We're forgiving one-third. We're not forgiving two-thirds of the sentence, right?
Correct. He'll be serving two-thirds of the sentence. Sorry for that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I had it correct.
Yes, he'll be serving two-thirds of the sentence. We're going to give them the third off will be the mandatory parole time.
Thank you.
So the offender management plan, as I mentioned, was an offender-specific supervision and services plan. So all offenders that are sentenced to 30 days or more are going to receive what we call the LSISV, and that is Level Service Inventory, the name of a screening tool. It's an assessment tool, and the SV stands for the screening version. And they will also receive an offender management plan. Any offender that serves, that scores a medium risk or higher on the screening version of the LSI are going to receive a full LSI assessment. And an LSI assessment is 54 questions that identifies risk needs with regard to recidivism. The screening version is only 8 questions, and it's ideal to use in an institutional setting. It will, where it's not feasible to complete a 54 question assessment for every offender, the SV has been found to be predictive of variety of outcomes essential for offender management, such as predicting misconduct involving those that are incarcerated, and it'll also identify those that need the full risk assessment. The offender management plan is completed with Offender Joe and is provided to Offender Joe within 90 days of his sentencing. And this is a working document while the offender's on custody, in custody, or while the offender is out on probation or parole. So it's a living document that is also often interchanged as a reentry plan, a release plan. You'll hear different terminology for it. But it is it's specific to the offender, and I will go into the next one.
So they actually get the paper copy of the plan?
Dan Traxinger is on the line, and he is with the Institutional Classification Office, and he can advise here if they get the actual paper copy.
So, Mr. Traxinger, can you put yourself on the record and let me know whether or not they actually get a physical copy of this offender management plan?
Record, Dan Traxinger, Classification Supervisor, Department of Corrections. If you could repeat the question, please.
Right, so we're talking about the offender management plan. And on the last slide that we were on, we were just told that each offender actually gets a copy of the plan. And so I just want to make sure, verify that they actually get the paper copy of the plan.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, the answer is yes, that they get a copy of the actual offender management plan. We view that offender management plan as their roadmap to receive the services and programs, and so it's kind of a roadmap through the whole rehabilitation process.
Well, that's interesting because about a week ago I spent time, about 3 hours at Lemon Creek, talking to about 15 individuals, and very few even knew what it was, and they never had a
If they were given a copy of it, they honestly didn't know what it was. So that's a little concerning that nobody seemed to know. They knew they were supposed to get a plan, or they talked about a plan, but as far as physically having a plan that they were working on, not one of us told us about such a document. So you could just check it out. I just find it.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
And one other question. So if I'm in jail, let's say, for 9 months, let's say, before I actually get sentenced, what am I able to do in that 9 months? Because I obviously don't have an offender management plan because I haven't been sentenced yet. So do I just sit on the bed and wait? Can I take classes? Can I? What can I do as an unsentenced person just waiting my time out?
To the chair. It varies institution by institution and what programs are available at that institution. An inmate can still participate in programming pre-sentencing, and that's true. They will not have an official offender management plan until they're sentenced, and it varies by what's available at that facility.
So if I'm at Lemon Creek and I've been sitting there for 9 months, do you know whether or not there would have been any program that I could have participated in, and I would have known that? And I've never been there as an inmate. That's why I'm asking.
To the chair, to clarify, are you asking, are there programs available for the unsentenced population at Lemon Creek?
I am.
The answer to that question is there's programs available. I don't have a list to provide at this moment in time what programs at Lemon Creek are available for this.
Wow. Well, it's interesting when you actually, in case the committee wants to go check things out. Met a few of them who've been sitting there unsentenced, frustrated because they wanted to do something besides sit there, and they were told until they got sentenced would they be able to participate in any program. Mm-hmm. So just kind of interesting to find out. Ms. Winkleman, go ahead.
Okay. For the record, Jen Winkleman, Director of Probation and Parole. So the offender management plan, as Mr. Traxinger pointed out, the living document that will address lots of different programs, classes, needs, risk needs that the they've identified the risks and the needs for each offender, and paid attention also to conditions that the court has issued in the judgment with regard to treatment conditions and other needs that are noted. And if classes or treatment are available while they're in custody and they are recommended by their institutional probation officer to take any of the courses or work with the education department, their offender management plan is updated frequently with regard to what they are doing in custody. The institutional probation officer will then update the offender management plan with referrals and program completions that are happening while they're in custody.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you through the chair. So the little thing that sent my antennas going up is if they can do treatment if treatment programs are available. So they have a plan, but if they're on a wait list for a treatment program or whatever, it's completely on availability, even though maybe it's been mandated or been part of their sentencing with the courts.
So through the chair to Representative Johnston, yes, it is only if it's available, and at different institutions will have different programs available. In their offender management plan, it will state in there if they are waitlisted for a class, so it will still show an attempt by the offender to enroll in a program, and it may be by no fault of their own that they weren't able to actually get into the program.
Thank you.
So other members have reminded me that Wednesday at 9 a.m. we're going to be going over the programs that we're going to have. So with that, could someone from the department, you know, not just tell us what the programs are in each institution, but what are the wait list numbers? I mean, especially there's some of those which, and how long each one of the programs lasts, because I know some of them are short as a couple weeks up to a couple years on that. So I think having that understanding you know, might give us an indication whether or not people are staying in jail longer because they can't get the treatment programs necessary for their release. Representative Josephson.
So I've confirmed that the OMP existed. It may not have been called OMP, but this essentially existed before SB 91, and the administration's not asking to end the OMP. I just thought that'd be helpful for the committee.
And before SB 91, it was my understanding is that they didn't have the plan until someone was like 2 or 3 years out, where now it's actually required much earlier on. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Mr. Traxinger might be able to better answer that.
For the record, Dan Traxinger, Classification Supervisor, Department of Corrections. To answer that question, the history of the OMP started approximately 2010 with the Department of Correction called the IRP, and which developed into what we now are is known as the OMP, the Offender Management Plan. And the requirement placed in actually SB 64 put the timelines that we see currently in place from SB 91 that required anyone serving a sentence of 30 days or more to get the OMP and replace the release plan.
Perfect. Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Before we go off that, then, what ties the failure to follow the OMP to a probation or parole violation?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, because they haven't been released on probation or parole, there isn't anything that would tie to a violation. However, it would be indicative of behaviors while they were in custody and what they've attempted to enroll in and what was available.
So someone, follow up? So someone who is on probation has already completed an OMP plan.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, an OMP was completed if they were in custody, if they served any time on their offense. So then an OMP would be completed prior to their release, and that would follow them to probation. So any activity that they did while they were in custody would be able to be, I guess, referenced following through while with their field probation or parole officer.
Follow up then. The OMP plan then follows through with the probation officer in the field so that it's if there are things there that they have to continue while they're on probation, then that plan is then transferred to the probation officer.
Yes, through the chair to Representative Carpenter, yes.
May continue.
So toward the end of Offender Joe's sentenced, he may be eligible for community placement. And this community placement revolves around community residential centers, otherwise known as CRCs, our halfway houses. An offender can be eligible for furlough to the community residential centers of the halfway house, or can also furlough into inpatient treatment. And Mr. Traxinger can talk a little bit to the classification of those, and then I will touch on the electronic monitoring.
For the record, Dan Traxinger, Department of Corrections. Furlough eligibility, so individuals that are placed on furlough need to be eligible to be placed there, and there's a couple criteria, basic criteria that we look for. First off is they have to serve one-third of their sentence, and based on their classification, we'll determine the length of furlough eligibility as community placement. For example, if an inmate is at minimum custody, they'll be eligible for the last 3 years of their sentence with the caveat of serving a third of their sentence already, medium custody, 2 years. And then our close custody inmates or our higher risk inmates would not be eligible for furlough, as well as sex offenders and or inmates that are convicted of arson.
So all of your CRCs have inpatient treatment centers or have inpatient treatment?
To the chair, no. We have specific inpatient locations that are furlough eligible. For example, the Clitheroe Center in Anchorage would be an example of an inpatient treatment center that we can furlough inmates to.
And what was the name of that one?
Okay. To the chair, Clitheroe.
And how many inpatients can it take at one time?
To the chair, I don't have those numbers available, but working with the administration, we can supply those for you.
Okay. Well, you knew you were coming to this meeting. I would have hoped you would have had those numbers. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do individuals get furloughed to a CRC requiring treatment, but the CRC does not offer the treatment?
Through the chair, a couple ways that that is addressed. One is if the treatment is provided at the halfway house and or out in the community by a community partner.
Just a follow-up for clarification. So somebody could get furloughed to a CRC that does not have the treatment that they're required, but that treatment could be offered in the economy or outside of the CRC, and that would only be in a case when that individual is, classified with a risk level that would allow them to leave the CRC. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, close. Once they are approved for furlough, part of the furlough plan might be that they receive treatment. If the treatment isn't supplied at that halfway house, there are community partners that they can go to receive treatment.
Okay, I guess a follow-up then would be low and medium classified inmates are able to leave the CRC?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
So again, if you can get us the list before Wednesday at 9 a.m. so we'll be able to discuss this, could you please give us a list of the service providers that you utilize? First of all, give us which CRCs actually have inpatient treatment, and then if they don't, where in the community that they would be able to get that service, and then who pays for it?
Through the chair, thank you.
No, thank you. Okay, moving on to electronic monitoring.
Okay, for the record, Jen Winkleman. Electronic monitoring, while incarcerated, if eligible, an offender can apply to serve the remainder of their sentence on electronic monitoring. And in order to be eligible, their current charge cannot be that of domestic violence. They must be within 3 years of their release date. They cannot be close custody, a close custody inmate.
Close custody inmates are, please?
Mr. Traxinger could probably best explain a close custody inmate.
To the chair, if you can repeat that question, please.
Could you please just tell us what a closed custody inmate is?
To the chair, so in the Department of Corrections, in our classification system, inmates are classified as minimum, medium, or closed custody. Closed custody is dependent upon your scoring in the classification matrix. Typically, your closed custody will be the closed custody will be based on their type of conviction and or their behavior while they're incarcerated.
I don't know about anybody else, but I didn't get it. So I'm not minimum, I'm not medium, I'm other. So can you give me an example of what kind of crime somebody might have committed and be under the close custody inmate classification?
To the chair, yes. For example, if someone is convicted of murder in the first degree, regardless of what their custody level is for their first year of incarceration, they will be overridden to a closed custody. That's a higher risk in our system. Other crimes that would likely result in a closed custody would be assaults. You combine that with other criteria to include their disciplinary history would would lead to a closed custody classification. For example, if an inmate is convicted, or excuse me, is found guilty of what we refer to as a beef sex or an assault on another inmate while in custody, that would likely increase their custody level to closed custody. Does that help?
So we're letting people that have murdered, that murdered people or people who are entering others in the institution, we're letting them out on electronic monitoring?
No, they're ineligible.
That's what they said. They're not eligible.
So you're saying close, they're not eligible?
Yeah.
Ever?
Close custody is not eligible, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I was really starting to wonder. Okay, so no DVs, must be within 3 years, and no close custody inmates.
And they can't have any major or high moderate infractions within the last 120 days, within the last 4 months of their incarceration. They have to be infraction-free for majors and high moderates.
And I'm assuming they didn't get good time credit either during those issues.
That is an institutional question that they... As a result of a disciplinary matter, they can lose lose good time, but they can appeal to get it back through the superintendents. So some probably do, some don't.
Doesn't sound like you had to be very good to get good time. Okay, you may continue.
So these folks that go on to electronic monitoring, if they are short-term, meaning they have less than a year to go before they're going to be released, They are approved by a supervisor, and if they are long-term over a year, they will be approved at the director's office. And at this time, when they are eligible for any sort of community placement, and if they are approved for community placement, their OMP will again be updated to indicate what they're doing and where they're going with regard to housing and programming. So now Offender Joe has completed his sentence, whether that was through furlough, electronic monitoring, or in the institution. And he has probation and parole following his release from incarceration. And when that happens, the institutional probation officer will send a notification of release, often referred to as an NOR, to the field probation office. This notification of release is going to give the receiving field office the information on the offender. Attached to it will be the offender management plan that has been working the whole time the offender was in custody, as well as where the offender is releasing to, as far as residing, any program completions, any necessary program that they need to take, as well as a copy of parole conditions or probation conditions. Because the field office will not have, they may have received a copy from the court when the offender was actually sentenced years prior, but the receiving field office will now have the latest information on the offender and ensure that the conditions and where the offender is releasing to is all up to date. And that is done within 30 days of the offender's release for all offenders except for sex offenders. Sex offenders, the release process starts earlier than that. In policy, it's 90 days. Oftentimes, you'll even see it prior to that because they're starting to plan the polygraphs, the containment model supervision approach that will happen upon release. So a notification of release, the NOR is sent for 30 days for all offenders other than sex offenders, and then that by policy is a 90-day plan. And we also have Mr. Edwards on the phone, and he could best touch on the parole. And this is going back just a smidge in the sense that Offender Joe could be possibly eligible for discretionary parole while he was in there. So the mandatory parole was he served 2/3 of a sentence. He got out on mandatory parole for 1/3 of it. And Mr. Edwards, who is also on the line as the executive director of the parole board, he can explain the process by which discretionary parole would happen with Offender Joe and whether or not he would come out on discretionary parole.
Okay, before we get to Mr. Edwards, we have a question from Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I go back to electronic monitoring and just to get a feel from you how successful that program is, how many folks successfully behave and adhere to the rules of electronic monitoring, and maybe tell me a little bit how that works.
So through the chair to Representative LeBon, my personal thoughts on electronic monitoring is that it is quite successful. I do feel that DOC has an excellent policy in place with regard to the electronic monitoring. And this is, we're talking about electronic monitoring for sentenced inmates. So the eligibility, as we kind of walked through, is very strict. You have probation officers that are monitoring the program. And it is, it's sort of a, for lack of a better word, a reward for the defendant that they're getting to now serve their time at home. I did pull numbers previously, and we had in the last 12 months less than 1% were escapes. So, and that is, you know, sometimes we'll get tamper alerts and things like that that the probation officer is trained on, and then we'll be able to monitor whether or not that is an equipment malfunction or is the offender messing with the equipment, essentially. But I do feel that it is very successful. We don't track following release. We can pull up name by name whether they've come back to know how successful they have been as far as the release goes. But I do believe that we see pretty good results with regard to our electronic monitoring, the sentenced electronic monitoring.
Thank you.
And how about on pretrial? Do we have the same record? Or is that... or do we have more issues with those that are on pretrial, on electronic monitoring?
To the chair, to it definitely don't have the same results because of the quantity that are ordered by the courts. They're not necessarily applying for electronic monitoring. The courts are putting, you know, ordering them to be placed on electronic monitoring.
But that program is ran by corrections. It's just the difference is parole, probation, the individual saying, I want to go do this portion of it. I know what I'm agreeing to, and I want to do this, versus on the pretrial, back to the matrix that we talked about the other day, gives that option to the courts, and the courts are saying, you're going to go on this, and they don't, and the pre-sentence person doesn't have any. Can they go to jail instead, or do they have to go on electronic monitoring?
To the chair, it's my understanding they have to go on electronic monitoring, what the court is releasing them out to it.
In the pretrial status?
In the pretrial status.
Okay, we may need to do some follow-up on that one, because I'm just not sure. And if we're forcing people out who think they may be dangerous or may do things wrong, and we're forcing them to go out there, that's probably not a good thing. In fact, it's not a good thing. Probably not. Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Carpenter.
Well, through the chair, Ms. Winkleman, as to the very last conversation, wouldn't it be as part of a bail application to get pretrial EM? In other words, it's not the court saying, boy, I need you out of this prison right away. It's the defendant and his attorney saying, hey, judge, can you cut us a break here? We're not guilty yet, and we think we'll do okay on EM.
So through the chair to Representative Josephson, Ms. Mead might be able to speak to that a little bit better with regard to how they release. I know we see the conditions of release, and it will say pretrial electronic monitoring on them.
Ms. Mead? So, because I think we're going back to the matrix and what the matrix tells one that they have, what they're eligible for. I guess our question is, if it says that you would be eligible to stay out on pre-sentencing, but yet you need more than just supervision, and the matrix says electronic monitoring. Does the court say you have to do that, or is there some type of discussion when they're standing, you know, in front of the judge?
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. To the chair, the way that bail review or arraignment works, where bail is being discussed, there's two things. Should the person be released on their own recognizance, or must there be monetary bail because the person is a risk of failing to appear or a threat to the community? If the person's released, I've really never heard of a defendant saying I'd rather stay in jail than being released on pretrial supervision. I think that hypothetically could happen, but as Mr. Skidmore spoke of the other day, it's an adversarial proceeding, and the defendant's goal at every bail hearing I've seen was to be not held in jail, and the prosecutor will sometimes, depending on the justice of the situation, say, but here's clear and convincing evidence that there should be monetary bail to hold the person in jail. The matrix doesn't go into such detail that it tells the court you, the result is this person should be on electronic monitoring. The matrix is just for non-violent, crimes against a person and non-serious felonies, it says there's a presumption you're going to be released, and then the court is free if that presumption holds to impose the conditions deemed appropriate. But all the attorneys and the defendant are in on that discussion to decide whether electronic monitoring is appropriate for this person.
In which that person has that discussion as well.
To the chair, the defendant is there. Yes.
Representative Josephson?
A follow-up on a different, actually not a follow-up, but a different topic, but one we've covered.
Okay, does anybody else, does it have to do with electronic monitoring?
No.
Does anybody else have a question on the case? And we'll come back to you, Representative Josephson. Representative Carpenter.
So electronic monitoring, from the corrections point of view, who makes the decision? Who's the responsible party that makes a decision whether the electronic monitoring goes forward with that, with a particular inmate? Is that the, at what level?
So to the chair, to Representative Carpenter through the chair, if they are sentenced to a year or less, then they will, the in-house supervisor, the probation supervisor, will make the decision. The offender will apply for electronic monitoring, and the matrix will be completed, and we will ensure that they're not DV, they're within 3 years of their release, so on and so forth. But then the in-house supervisor makes the determination. If it's over a year sentence, then the director's office must make that decision. It gets forwarded on to the director's office for placement. Call it a long-term designation, essentially.
Okay, thank you. And the furlough, one-third sentence, is that also the case for the electronic monitoring? They have to have completed a third of their sentence before they can do electronic monitoring?
That would be a question for Mr. Traxinger.
For the record, Dan Traxinger, Department of Corrections, through the chair. Furlough eligibility requires one-third of their sentence be served.
Does that also apply to electronic monitoring?
Through the chair, that question be better answered by Director Winkleman there on electronic monitoring. I was speaking specifically to the furlough eligibility.
So through the chair to Representative Carpenter, no, they do not have to, as long as they meet the other requirements, they do not have to have served a third of their time.
Is there any minimum time that they have to serve before they're eligible to leave on electronic monitoring?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, no, as long as they meet all the other requirements.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Madam Chair. This is a general question around electronic monitoring. I know a couple of years ago there was an issue of some areas of the state having greater access to the option of electronic monitoring. Does that still exist today? Is there a diversity in the ability for the court system and or, in this case, the corrections? Do they all have access to electronic monitoring?
So
as much as needed?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, your question is good in the sense that, no, it's not available everywhere. And some of it is because we don't have officers in the area able to respond to the alerts that come in with regard to whether it's equipment or even a violation status. Other reasons we have difficulty is that the equipment just doesn't work in some areas. There are some areas in Western Alaska we have had difficulty with the equipment working, and Bethel comes to mind quickly, as we had some trial runs out there with some equipment, and I know they're always updating, and we're hopeful to get it in some of our other areas where there are probation officers, but no, it's not available everywhere.
And is that the same for the court system?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, the court system doesn't actually do or supervise any electronic monitoring. All so I'm not certain if I'm answering your question.
In the pretrial thing and that whole deal, does some people have access to the option of electronic monitoring in the state and other people don't because of, again, whatever factors that are at play there?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, that is correct. Even for pretrial, the court can't order people on to electronic monitoring in some areas because it's not available. So that's true.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson, new topic.
Yes, a topic we've taken up, but not in the last 15 minutes, and that's parole and probation. And I'm trying to get a better sense of this, Ms. Winkleman. So, for example, if you had a 9-year felony sentence with 3 years suspended, six years to serve, and the math is going to get a little challenging, but essentially they would get mandatory parole if they behaved, and so they would do 4 years. And if they then did something beyond a technical violation, when they were released, and they could be released after 4 years with no ankle monitor, no nothing. They could just be, with the permission of the parole board, out in humanity, as I understand it. But if they did something egregious, the parole board could say, we're reimposing that one-third off, those 2 years, so you're going to jail for those 2 years. And then for the same bad act, they could have the 3 years that was suspended imposed. So it's 2 plus 3 unless they're running concurrently. And I guess my question is, first of all, is my hypothetical correct? And secondly, whether these two train tracks were running concurrently or consecutively, is that done at sentencing or how does that work, do you know?
So through the chair to Representative Josephson, great question. So they can run simultaneously and receive two separate violations through the parole board and through the court. The other thing, the Department of Corrections has a policy that if it is a technical violation, we will file with only one entity. And we file with the parole board first so that they aren't having violations in both entities at the same time. As far as the court and what's running consecutively or concurrently, the court may better be able to speak to my understanding it's the last entity that imposes sentence will state whether or not it would run consecutive or concurrent if it were to be a violation that were run in both.
So follow up.
Well, we also have, do we want to go ahead before, because your questions might be able to be answered. We have Mr. Edwards, who's the director of the Parole Board Department of Corrections. And if we go into the discretionary parole and into that topic, you might get the answers you're looking for. Let's try that, and then if you don't, then you get first shot.
Sure.
Okay, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jeff Edwards. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Board of Parole. To the question, there's a lot going on in that question. I could say, just as a reminder, the committee, it may have been mentioned earlier, the paroling system deals with actual prison terms, how long an inmate's going to be in prison, and the court deals with suspended terms. We operate completely independent of each other. In the example that was provided, upon serving two-thirds of a sentence, and that's the prison term that doesn't include any suspended time, the actual hard-bit prison term, the individual would have been released, factually stated in the question, to mandatory parole. If that individual violated parole, and at the same time, I said they would operate differently than the court, at the same time the person is on probation for the term, that they owe the court for the suspended term. So we have two different agencies with two different math equations, if you will, and if the individually violated parole and probation, they could have, and if it was a not what's called a non-technical, this is kind of another area that hasn't really been touched on that I've heard, But if the violation was non-technical in nature, either it was a new criminal offense or a violation of a sex offender treatment condition, the board can, in fact, impose those years that was mentioned, and the court could impose a suspended period of time. Technical violations are a whole different thing. I'm not sure we're quite ready to go there yet, but I can offer clarifying if I didn't answer the question in full.
That sounds good, and I think she's having you ready to go into discretionary parole and explain that to us.
Certainly, Madam Chair. As mentioned just a minute ago by myself, we deal with hard bed prison terms, and so after sentencing, and we have an example in the PowerPoint there, following sentencing, the Department of Corrections does the math calculation. That math calculation is coined in the phrase time accounting. They take the sentence issued by the court at the time of sentencing and issue what's called a timesheet, and all those math equations are on the timesheet, in which the inmate would have a copy to. And if it's a sentence long enough, in excess of 180 days, part of those math equations will include two parts, the mandatory release date and the discretionary application date. I just mentioned the mandatory portion. There's no hearing as far as a mandatory release, as stated in the word, mandated or mandatory. They automatically get released after serving two-thirds of their sentence if they have not lost or forfeited any statutory good time while an inmate in prison. As mentioned, they don't get a hearing. We don't evaluate their risk. They're just mandatorily released, and they'll be on parole supervision under mandatory parole. Prior to that, however, most inmates sentenced post-SB 91 are eligible for what's called discretionary parole. And the time calculation gets a little more complicated. I was just issued in that example, but on the slide example, we offered a little bit of an easier math equation and said that the inmate, Fender Joe, who was sentenced to 3 years in prison, that is telling us that the judge said go to prison for 3 years, and he would know that he would be eligible for discretionary parole after serving one quarter of the sentence, which in our example is 9 months. The mandatory release date is 2 years. So for discretionary parole, the inmate has an opportunity to appear before the parole board, and they will make a release decision for or against or a continuation order. What's important to note is that we're working with the 9-month mark up until the 2-year mark and anywhere in between. We don't have to release after 9 months. We could say release anywhere up to 1 day short of the 2 years. So that's the window in which we're working with for what's called the discretionary parole hearing. We can continue the case up until the 2-year mark, or we can offer a release, or we can just simply say deny parole, you serve up to the 2 years and release to mandatory parole. And Madam Chair, maybe I'll pause there. It's kind of a complex system if there's any questions.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I understand that discretionary parole did not exist prior to Senate Bill 91?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that's not true. It's been in our system since stated, I believe.
Thank you for clarifying.
If you'd like me to expand on it, SB 91 simply expanded the number of inmates and class of crimes that are eligible to apply for discretionary parole.
Okay, very good. You may continue.
So along those same conversation lines, prior to SB 91, there was a somewhat limited class of inmates that were eligible for discretionary parole. Post SB 91, prospective of January 1st, 2017, anybody sentenced prospective of that date, most of the time would be eligible to apply at some point during their incarceration for discretionary parole. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, those calculations are all done by the Department of Corrections, dependent on the length of sentence. Current law, convictions of a Class A, Class B, Class C felony are all eligible for discretionary parole at a quarter of the sentence. Unclassified felonies, murder one, murder two, mix one, kidnapping, etc., are eligible at a third or the mandatory minimum. And we're getting into kind of technical terms, and the complexity issue of time accounting is maybe far exceeding what I need to get into today. But the mandatory minimum, every unclassified sentence has a mandatory minimum or a mandatory term of imprisonment that a judge must set as a minimum. And so they're eligible after serving that or one-third, whatever is longer. So what you're finding current law is that a lot more people, as a matter of fact, pre-SB 91, we were interviewing just around 200 inmates per year for discretionary parole. Prospective of January 1st, we're up to just under 1,000 per year. So you can see how the law affected the number of inmates who are eligible for discretionary parole, and in fact, how the number of hearings my board was mandated to convene.
So is there any way that we could just get a comparison on that so we could better understand that versus try to list it all out for us? If we could just, and maybe corrections can just get it for us, you know, what was the list of those who could get discretionary before 91 and now what does the list look like? That it'd be just a lot easier than trying to name as many of those as you could.
And Madam Chair, this is Jeff Edwards again. Yes, we do have that, in fact, and it offers a lot of clarity.
That would be perfect. Thank you. You may continue.
That's all I had, Madam Chair, at this point. I can be available for questions.
Okay, Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you to the Chair, and I'm not sure who I'm going to be asking this to, but when we have the presentations on parole programs, and my concern is we have this management plan that starts out when they're convicted, and it goes through parole, and it has treatment programs that go there. I'd like to know with the programs, what are the wait lists for when they're on parole or the accessibility to the programs? And the other question I'd like answered is how many people that are in parole, discretionary or mandatory parole, who are in parole in communities other than their home communities. So that's just for the next presentation. Thank you.
That would be perfect for Wednesday morning because we're going to be talking about treatment programs. So it'd be about not just in the institution, but as Representative Johnston just said, the parole, probation, and also understanding like the sex offenders class, mostly is in Juneau, and it's a two-year course, so a lot are having to be brought here, and who knows where, you know, whether they're from Fairbanks or Beth or where they are. So hopefully we'll have that answer on Wednesday morning. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The discretion of the parole board, is that determined by regulation within the Department of Corrections, or is that specifically statute that determines the boundaries here or the discretion of the parole board?
Mr. Edwards?
Chair, Representative Carpenter. Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Carpenter, are you specifically talking about sentences that are eligible or the discretion of the board to release an inmate, if I can ask a follow-up?
The discretion to release an inmate.
So two sections in statute, through the Chair, Representative Carpenter, guide the parole board, if you will, into making release decisions. One section is specific to unclassified felonies, and the other governs the remainder of the felonies as far as discretion, if you will, to release. The unclassified, there's a may clause in there, which means the board may release somebody on discretionary parole, and there's four governing factors that the board must consider when making a release decision. Regulation has it's more inclusive. It has like 23 factors that we shall consider. For the Class A, Class B, and the Class Cs, there really is a shall release. provision in Alaska statute 3316-100F, and if they meet the requirements, and the discussion was really good for the OMP, and they call it a case finance statute. However, if they're in compliance with that OMP and haven't violated any of the institutional rules, there's a shall clause unless there is clear and convincing evidence, and you heard that a little bit in the presentation last week with the court system, unless there's clear and convincing evidence that releasing the individual will present a risk to the public. So there's a main shall clause, just to kind of recap. There's a presumption of release if they're in compliance with their OMP. They haven't committed any write-ups in the institution. They shall be released, unless, of course, that factor I just mentioned.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to prejudge my view of the world, but one of the things about SB 91 that concerned me was that you have a five-member parole board, and if each of them said that they believed it was more likely than not that the inmate, whatever, would reoffend, all of them said likely to reoffend, that's not enough. You have to find clear and convincing evidence that they will. So if to the individual they said there's a 51% chance they're going to reoffend, they have to release them on discretionary parole.
Things we'll need to look at. Ms. Wiggleman, was there anything else you wanted to end with today?
Not in regards to parole. I have a couple final slides. I don't know if you want to do those right now. So offender Joe releases to supervision, and we conduct a risk assessment when they're on supervision. Whether they're on parole or probation, it's the same risk assessment. The 54 questions determine risk and needs, update the offender management plan, and come up with a plan on which conditions of probation or parole in which they're required to complete all of them, but in which order that the offender management plan is updated and the treatment that is ordered is addressed. Some of folks have co-occurring conditions and need to take sex offender treatment as well as substance abuse, as well as get their GED. And so it's just determining where the availabilities are, where the wait lists are, and getting folks into a supervision plan. As Ms. Mead talked about, the earned compliance credits, the administrative sanctions and incentives, violation reports, and early termination, those are just factors to consider surrounding supervision. The earned compliance credits they were established as part of 91, and they were a program where all offenders are eligible to earn compliance credits, time off supervision, 30 days for 30 days of good behavior. That is the earned compliance credits. The sex offenders and DV offenders, they must complete treatment before they're able to be discharged as a result of earning those credits. Offenders are given an orientation form at intake to explain how the program works. Violations with regard to sanctions and incentives, as the sanctions and incentives words may indicate, incentives are things like verbal praise and basically responses to positive behavior, where sanctions are responses to undesired behavior. And those are, they happen administratively within the probation and parole offices with the offenders. And then if it rises to a level of needing to file a violation report with either the parole board or the courts, then we have a parole violation report or a petition to revoke probation. And early termination, as Ms. Mead stated, probation officers are required to file for early termination when folks meet a certain criteria. Offender Joe completes probation and parole successfully. We notify Offender Joe of this successful completion in the office. We give them a letter stating their voter rights, their right to be on a jury has been reinstated, and they have completed, as well as the notice goes to the court that they are off due, if they are off due to the earned compliance credits. And the final slide is just the reminder that the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission is required to oversee the implementation. We ourselves, Department of Corrections and Department of Public Safety, provide and collect data to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. That's it. question.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation. Representative Carpenter?
I have one quick question. I think the answer is probably no here. Data being collected for CRC furlough, electronic monitoring, discretionary parole, is there data being collected to identify when we're successful and when we're not successful in our discretion or our assessment or our use of a risk analysis tool? Are we collecting data to know when we've got a problem and when we don't?
So through the chair to Representative Carpenter, we are collecting data. How that's analyzed, I am not certain. To know whether or not we're collecting it, to know whether or not folks are successful or not.
So, follow up? Here's the crux of the problem, is that the pain being felt in our communities, are people going to prison for any number of amount of time, sentences, whatever, and they're coming back out, and the pain is being felt with people doing the crime again, and for a whole host of reasons. Except that I cannot get an understanding from the Department of Corrections or from the courts, but mostly corrections, on where the problem actually lies. We've got individuals who are not judges and who are not, they're just employees, making decisions on whether somebody should get out or not. And yet that person reoffends and is back in, and that employee is still making a decision. And I don't want to cast aspersions on the employees necessarily. We all make mistakes occasionally, but we don't have any data to back up that we're actually making good decisions with individuals. And so
to help you with your frustration, we will also have the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, who's collecting most of the data, and we'll bring up those particular those questions you just brought up to find out whether or not it's in every area or what data they're collecting. I think that'll help you with your questions.
Thank you.
And with that, tomorrow morning, we're gonna hear from Alaska State Troopers and also local municipalities and their police officers of things that they see that are working, things that they'd like to see improved. If you have a favorite officer that you would like to have testify, all they gotta do is call at 9 o'clock in the morning, just to kind of give a feel with the boots on the ground. So until then, it's 5:12 and we're adjourned.